Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I mean, don't get me wrong, not a perfect game. Far from it. In fact, the game was not clean. In fact, the game was pretty damn sloppy. However, pretty damn entertaining. Russell Wilson called it, quote, probably the craziest game I have ever played in, end quote. I'm not sure I'd go that far. I mean, far be it for me to say what is or is not the craziest game that guy's ever played in. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it was good. Really good and really wild. 49ers came out quickly. The crowd there, which has been mocked in the past, was absolutely peaking, rocking, like it was for Cleveland on that Monday night game. And just like the Cleveland game, the Niners get up early. They were up 10-0. It looked like they might be on their way to a nationally televised beatdown. But that was not happening. In fact, that was never going to happen. Not last night, and not with Russell Wilson playing the way he is right now. And not when Seattle's defense finally got rolling. I mean, it felt like every time Jimmy G dropped back, Jadeveon Clowney was up in his face. And he was definitely in his head. Definitely in his head, and there was a stretch when Garoppolo seemed like he was rattled. I get it. Clowney is a giant man. He's fast, he's strong, he's explosive. He was putting clown suits on the 49ers offensive line. Joe Staley, Mike McGlinchey, they may not have been fully healthy, yet Clowney was destroying these guys. He's just moving back and forth along the line, humiliating guys, and scooping up the rock and running with it.
Shotgun snap is high. Four-man rush. He's hit. Brought down. Ball is loose. Picked up by Clowney at the 10. On drives to the 5. Runs into the end zone. Touchdown, Seattle. A defensive touchdown on a fumble, and the Seahawks are on the board.
Westwood One Radio. So that game, which looked like was going to be a beatdown, changed dramatically with that one play. That play obviously changed the entire game. I mean, did we really forget about Clowney? Did you really forget about Clowney? Do you remember that time he hit that dude from Michigan? Did you ever see that play? Didn't get shown very often on TV, but it was pretty cool. In fact, this play from the third quarter last night, also pretty cool.
Garoppolo's face is dripping with sweat as he looks through that face mask. He's at his own 32. He drops back on second and 18. Crumbling pocket. Ball knocked away. It's loose. Seattle got it. Seattle has just recovered a second fumble from Garoppolo tonight. And look where they've got the ball at the San Francisco 25.
Look who knocked it out. 9-0 from Seattle. It was Jadeveon Clowney once again.
That's it. And Seattle converts that turnover into a TD. And then they're up 21-10. At that point, it seemed like that game was pretty much over. San Francisco's offense was struggling without George Kittle and Emmanuel Sanders. Seattle's defense had gotten rolling, and it was just a matter of time before Seattle finished it off. That is, until my guy, Jermaine Ifedi, went legend for the Seahawks. Let me set the stage once again. Seattle up 21-10, just over 12 minutes left. The Seahawks have the ball. They call a pass play. Well, 10 guys in gray prepared for a pass play, but Jermaine Ifedi was preparing for the run of a lifetime. Roll this, please.
Receiver motion, snap, spin, fake handoff, blocked by Carson. Here comes Warner. They got him back at the 25. The ball loose. It's picked up on the play by Buckner from the 5 down the near sideline. Touchdown, San Francisco.
What an absolute legend. Ifedi sees his quarterback in trouble. He's about to get sacked, so he grabs the ball from him and starts running. I mean, the ball may have been coming out, but Ifedi definitely was active in getting it out from Wilson and then turning upfield and looking to run. My man started running like he was going to go all Lamar Jackson on everyone. Gee, you're not housing that one. There is no Heisman trophy in the NFL. And shocker, big fella, he did not hold on to the rock. San Francisco stripped him. DeForest Buckner scored, and they're right back in it. Buckner could not believe what he was seeing or what Ifedi was thinking.
I mean, we were all just rushing, and Russell was wrapped up. I'm pretty sure, the guys got to him, and all of a sudden I saw one of the linemen take the ball from him, and I was just wondering, I'm like, what the hell is this dude doing? You know what I mean? And he tried to run with it, which was crazy.
What the hell is this dude doing? And he tried to run with it, which is crazy. And then he had the camera cutting to Pete Carroll on the sideline. And very clearly you could see Carroll say, quote, how did that happen? How did that happen? Which was priceless. I can tell you how that happened. The big man was looking to make a big play. And it blew up big time. Afterwards, Pete Carroll was still incredulous.
What was he thinking? He thinks he's going to score. What was he thinking? I think he was doing this thing, the Heisman and all that. I don't know what he was. That was terrible.
What was he thinking? That was terrible. Man, I was waiting for the big man to execute that Lamar Jackson spin move, get into open space, and start abusing fools. I know this. That's what he was thinking. Pete Carroll, quote, it was terrible. No, it wasn't, Pete. It was awesome. Because not only was that an amazing moment, but it made that game 21-18. After the two-point conversion, and it played an enormous role in sending that game into OT. And the OT was its own circus. You've got Russell Wilson scrambling on second down. That was called back for being in the grasp. Then turned into a 3rd-and-16. A 3rd-and-16, which he picked up himself.
Wilson in the gun. There's the snap. Four-man rush. Sets in the pocket. Flushed out. Backs away. Gets away from traffic. He's on the numbers. He throws on the run. Passes caught downfield by Turner. Spins by a defender at the 40. He broke the tackle. He's by the 35. And down to the San Francisco. 32. All on the far sideline in front of his own bench.
Vintage Russell Wilson. And then three plays later, vintage Dre Greenlaw.
14-yard line of San Francisco, second down and 5 in overtime. Here's the shotgun snap, a four-man rush. Wilson lofts a pass down the far side. Intercepted. Picked off on the play by the rookie Greenlaw at the 10. Got a block at the 15. Cuts at the 20. Breaks a tackle, 25. Goes to the 30. Breaks another tackle. Up the sideline, 40. Got a block at the 50. Out of bounds at the Seattle 45.
Wild freaking game. I mean, Seattle's going to win it. And then at that point, it looks like Frisco is going to steal it. But they were never close on the game-winning field goal attempt. Then Russ gets another look, but had to punt. And that's where things got interesting because San Francisco had the ball on their own 20 with less than 2 minutes left. Three incompletions later, and they were punting, which I will get back to in a minute. But you give Russell Wilson a third look, he's going to take it, and he's going to capitalize. And then Seattle capped it off with this.
Michael Dixon puts it down. That kick is away. And that kick is good! The Seahawks win! It's good! From 42, the Seahawks in overtime win for the second time in 2 weeks. And they beat the undefeated, now once defeated, San Francisco 49ers.
Seahawks radio, and as I tweeted last night, if you give that guy three looks, he's going to get it done. So an enormous win for Seattle. Really brass to go on the road and beat the unbeaten Niners in their house. They weren't perfect, but they were impressive. Russell Wilson, not even having his best game, far from it, is still on a different level. Might be your MVP. And if you still do not understand how good this guy is, then that's on you. If you can't acknowledge that, if you can't respect that, that is the very definition of hating. This guy's ability to make something out of nothing is unreal. It's Favre-like. It's what separates the good from the great and the great from the best ever. Wilson has got that. Garoppolo does not, at least not yet. And Wilson is the reason why they're in that spot right now. Well, he and that defense. A defense which had been so maligned but showed up huge last night. Now, I know some of you are going to come in and try to bash the Niners. Talk about how the Niners were overhyped, overrated. Who had they played? They're paper tigers. They're paper tigers. To which I say, the hell they are. I mean, yeah, there was a stretch where Jimmy G seemed to be out of sorts, out of rhythm. Then again, I would be out of rhythm also if Clowney were in my face all night long and my best targets were not there. And the other guys who were there were having some really tough drops. They played their worst game of the season without their Pro Bowl tight end and their number one receiver for half the game, and they still had a chance to win it. They still had a chance to go 9-0. And here's the thing for San Francisco. Seattle was only in position to win that game because the Niners let them back in. Yes, I said it. San Francisco could have played, and follow me on this, all right? This is going to be hard for some of you to follow. San Francisco could have played for the tie on that last possession. You can make the argument, maybe, as counterintuitive as it sounds, you can make the argument that maybe they should have played for a tie. Follow me on this. A tie hurts Seattle a lot more than it hurts San Francisco. A tie would have kept the Niners 2 games ahead of Seattle in the loss column. As it is, they're only 1 game up now. I mean, sure, it's not the best message to send your team, and I respect the thinking behind playing for the win. You play to win the game, but you also play to win your division, and a tie would have had them 2 games up on Seattle in the division. And when you consider that Kittle and Sanders were out, how likely was it that they were going to drive 60-plus yards to get into position for a game-winning field goal by a rookie kicker who just missed a game-winning field goal? If you take the tie, you're still unbeaten. You still have a 2-game lead on Seattle. All right, so, I mean, I could argue that point. I could. But playing for the tie does not fit into what this 49ers team is, right? They're aggressive. They're confident. They don't settle. I get it. That's their identity, except for them last night. That identity didn't work out for them. So, the question, is playing for the tie the coward's move?
Cowards.
Or is it the smart move? It's actually both. I'm not going to kill them for not doing it last night, but I would not have killed them if they did that last night because they weren't going down the field, and they didn't, and they gave the ball back. Today's episode of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by CBS Sports HQ, the brand new streaming sports news network. It is live 24/7 and it costs you absolutely nothing. That's right. Sports coverage that is always on and always free. I love it. Straight sports, straight intel, and free is me. CBS Sports HQ has coverage, which is always focused on the game. A lot of highlights, breaking news as it happens, fantasy advice, and something we care about a lot around here, gambling picks, and analysis to get you the extra edge you need. I know that when I turn on CBS Sports HQ, I'm going to get the tips and the trends that I need to win my bets. And don't forget, you get access to all this great coverage completely free. No catch, no hook. Not free for a week or a month, or if you have some special cable package, totally and completely free for everybody. You don't even need a login. Just download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, or other connected device at any time and watch CBS Sports HQ. No fake debates, just sports for real sports fans at the great price of nothing. You don't even have to log in or sign up for anything at all. Just download the CBS Sports app and watch CBS Sports HQ today. Rick Carlisle is my guest. Rick, it is good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I'm well. Great to be back in the jungle. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time, so it's good to have you back. Rick, let me start off here. You're coming off a tough loss to Boston last night where Kristaps Porzingis had a rough game. Is it something you and he spend any time thinking about and talking about after the game, or do you just kind of flush that and just keep moving?
Well, communication is one of the big parts of coaching and being a player. You know, I told him and I told the team after the game that the loss we needed to flush, he needed to flush that particular game with respect to what happened with him. But then when we got into the hotel last night in New York, you know, I did speak with him a bit about, you know, where we are and some things that we can tweak to help everybody's situation. So, you know, there's a fine line when you talk about flushing things. He's had some great games. He had a 32-point game against Portland. He had a 28-point game against New York a couple games ago. And then last night was just a tough night. And, you know, he and Luka Doncic are going to get a lot of attention by the other team, and they're going to try to make it as hard as possible on those guys.
Rick Carlisle is joining us. All right, Rick, so in terms of where you're at right now, when you've got the retirement of a legend like Dirk, and then you get a huge piece like Kristaps back on the floor, it's going to change the identity of the team. That goes without saying. 10 games in, do you have a good sense of the identity of this team, or is it still something that everybody's trying to figure out?
Well, we've talked about it quite a bit. And, you know, as you go along, you kind of form your identity, but I do think it's important from a coaching standpoint to to communicate to the team, you know, what we're about and what we need to be about. You know, in my mind, and I think the players would agree with this, you know, we're an elite offensive team. So being a team that can score has got to be part of our identity. Our scoring has got to energize us to be persistent and aggressive defensively. And we're smart and we're tough-minded. And so I think those are the pillars of who we are and who we need to be. We're not a big, huge, bruising physical team like a couple of teams that we've played. But our skill and our persistence have to be our calling card.
We're talking to Rick Carlisle. We're talking Mavericks basketball. Rick, you mentioned Luka. He had another huge game last night, 34 points, 9 assists, and 6 rebounds. I mean, there's so many different aspects to his game that we could talk about. His footwork, his balance, his passing, that floater he's added. I can go on. It almost feels like hyperbole, but has the league ever seen anybody like him before?
Oh, wow. You know, Jim, he's so special. And I don't think there's been a guy quite like him at this stage of his young career. You know, LeBron James was equally great, I think, but his style of play was a little bit different. I think when he first came in the league, he was playing a little more off the ball and stuff. You know, we feel Luka is a full-fledged point guard, and he has just such amazing vision, awareness, dexterity, skill, as you mentioned, you know, balance. The thing about him that's very deceptive is his size, power, speed, and strength. And he's just a very rare combination for a 20-year-old kid / young man of those abilities. And he's, you know, his skill level is really through the roof. So he's just one of the most compelling guys in our league to watch right now. And I mean, I wouldn't trade him for anybody, and I'd pay to watch him play.
We're talking Rick Carlisle. Rick, I mean, I can do an entire interview. I can do an entire hour and just ask you questions about him. One more thing, though. I mean, you've been around some really special players as a teammate and as head coach, guys like Larry Bird, Reggie Miller, Jason Kidd, Dirk. They all had really different games, but is there anything that they all had in common, and does Luka have some of that?
Yes, and really, you know, I guess this is more of a parallel or a comparison with, you know, with Jason Kidd and Larry Bird. You know, those guys had the rare ability to see things that were going to happen before they happened. They could anticipate. They had a real pulse for their teammates who needed a shot. You know, who was hot and finding a way to get that guy in a position to get another shot to you know, to try to ride him a little bit. And so, you know, Luka's just, you know, for a guy this age to have this kind of overall awareness, not just the awareness, but the ability to execute, you know, is just pretty amazing.
We're talking to Rick Carlisle. All right, Rick, back to Porzingis for 1 minute, because he is coming back from a knee injury. On top of that, as you've pointed out, he's playing in a system, and it's a different system than what he's accustomed to. It's more open. It's free-flowing. So it's a process that's playing out for itself. The next step in that process, Rick, is him going to Madison Square Garden and you guys taking on the Knicks. In your mind, is it just another opponent and just another building? Or when you consider that he was dealt and now he's coming back, is it impossible to believe that this one won't feel a little bit different to him?
Well, these things are emotional, Jim. You know that. There's just no way to get around that. You know, we're in New York today. We played last night. We have an off day today. We have a practice day tomorrow. We've got to focus on the things that we've got to work on as a team to get better. You know, New York beat us 4 days ago in a game where they took the game to us. They had a great shot-making game, and they were physical and killed us on the boards. I mean, we've got to get better in those areas. you know, they're a team that's going through their own set of challenges. And look, the whole thing shapes up as a very compelling game and a very compelling situation. But we got to make it about team, and we got to make it about basketball, and we got to make it about what we have to do to compete our best together, and try to limit some of the other distractions that will inevitably come with this game.
We're talking to Rick Carlisle. You know, Rick, when you look at that offense, your former assistant Dwayne Casey had said that one of the challenges when guys first started getting into it was finding guys who were smart enough and intuitive enough to understand and read defenses and then good enough to make the defense pay. So when you look at that offense, I'm curious, how much of that style has roots in coming up in upstate New York and playing pickup ball with people who just understand the game, so you're not slowing it down to call plays but are more intuitive with it?
You mean playing with other guys like me that didn't have any ability?
That's not what I'm saying, Rick. I'm saying guys who are like really smart like you.
Well, I think the reality of today's game, Jim, it's not a play-calling game. It's a play-making game. And one of the things that, you know, we have a really important responsibility to do in NBA coaching is to teach our players and to nurture them to evolve so that they understand how to flow with the game and how to get in positions to either make plays or help plays be made. And so, you know, look, it's very easy to get into a thing where you're, you know, we're all trying to, you know, analyze KP situations so much that we get into a crazy overanalyzation. Listen, he's shown that he plays well with our guys. There's some nights where teams are going to target him and take him out and make it really difficult, like last night in Boston. And when that happens, you got to circle the wagons, and regroup and get ready to go back to battle again. And that's what we're doing right now.
You know, one thought, Rick, also, in terms of guys making plays, you've talked about the need to randomize the game, make it as unpredictable as possible, just so you can get shots. You know, other coaches around the league talk about the fact that you got to have smart players, but you want to control the game and you want to call plays. Why is it more important to you maybe to randomize it as opposed to locking these things in and calling these plays and letting these guys be unpredictable?
Well, when you got a guy like Luka Doncic, you know, you really have got to maximize his ability to do what he does, which is really affect the game in so many different ways offensively. And he does it defensively too, because he's a great rebounder. Look, we have plays, but the nature of play calling is much different today than it was 2 or 3 years ago, and certainly 18 years ago when I got into this. You know, back in those days, you'd run something to get a shot for somebody or to get a catch for somebody. And now it's much more about running an action to create a playmaking opportunity for your team. And look, we certainly have plays where we're trying to get the ball to Luka or to KP, but it's just it's much more in the direction of flow and random and playmaking and space. Because when you look at today's game, most teams, you know, the vast majority of teams are playing a five-out spacing. And so it opens up the middle for drives. And when you get drives, you can attack the rim. You can get kick out threes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, when I came in as a head coach and when I came in, you know, almost 30 years ago as an assistant coach, people were playing three perimeter guys and two big guys. And the spacing looked totally different. You know, people weren't shooting threes at, you know, a rate of, you know, 35 to 50 per game. And so, the geometry of the game has gotten way different, and you know the language of the game has gotten way different. And so, you know, we're constantly teaching that language on the offensive end, and then defensively, hey, you've got more challenges than you've ever had with all the space and all the skill. So it just makes NBA basketball so compelling on a night-to-night basis. And this game coming up on Thursday is another compelling game, no question about it.
Well said. Dallas at New York on Thursday. Dallas is in second in the Southwest. He is in his 12th season as Mavs head coach, an NBA champion as both a player and a coach, and he was Coach of the Year back in 2002. Rick Carlisle, my guest. Rick, great to get caught up. Always great to have you in the jungle. Rick, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Take care.
We are joined once again by Kevin Harvick. Kevin, good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back, Kevin. So it's Tuesday. We're a few days away from the final race of the season Sunday. The title is on the line. What is the mood like for you and the team as you get ready for a big Sunday?
Well, right now I'm just trying to survive. It's really cold. We're on a media tour here in New York, and it's windy and cold. But, you know, I don't think that'll dampen the spirits of our team. We've had a great season of a lot of ups and downs, but, you know, the thing I like about that is, as a group, we've really battled together to put ourselves in position to get through the season and position ourselves to race for another championship. So we're going to enjoy the week and try to come out on top on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm going to follow you up on that point, Kevin, in 1 minute. I want to get kind of a sense from you, though. When you're on a media tour and you've got the other members of the championship for Martin Truex Jr., Kyle Busch, Denny Hamlin, they're doing some media as well today. When you see each other, what's it like right now? I mean, does it feel a little bit different than it would before any other race? It must.
Yeah, you know, I always tell people there's different interactions, and I would view these as quality interactions just because of the fact that you're not in that competitive environment. So outside of that environment, you know, I think for the most part we all get along pretty well and have raced against each other for, you know, 15, 16 years. So it's, you know, right now everybody's having a good time, you know, doing the media stuff that we have to do, and the competition stuff will come on Sunday, and everybody will become a little bit more greedy and trying to do what they can to win a championship for their team.
Kevin Harvick joining us. You know, Kevin, if you go back from the Daytona 500 through Talladega, you led laps in three of those 10 races. So if I had told you then that you'd be in the final four in November, what would you have said? For instance, would you have been surprised, or did you always know you'd get things going?
You know, that's a great question. Really, the first half of the year, we struggled to get our cars where we needed to be. We went through the summer, you know, leading laps, started winning races, and we're able to compete. But we were still very inconsistent. And, you know, I think as we've, you know, got into the playoffs in the last 10 weeks, we've performed more consistently. Texas, obviously, was a good weekend for us. And getting to victory lane and kind of put all the pieces together, and we're able to put a whole day together and win the race. So, I would say before the playoffs started, I was a little bit nervous as to what the outcome was going to be because of the fact that we had so many inconsistencies throughout the season of good weeks, bad weeks. And, you know, in the playoffs, we put it all together. We're consistent and we're able to position ourselves to go to Miami and race for another championship.
So obviously, Kevin, when you face a challenge, and it's been a challenging year, but when you face a challenge, obviously you're either going to learn or you're going to crumble. How much have you learned about yourself as a driver and about the team as a whole this year?
Yeah, you know, I think as a team, we've been through this before, when we switched from Chevrolet to Ford, having to change every car and the mindset and the things that you think about with the new rules this year. You know, we knew that we were going to have to be open-minded, didn't really know where we were going to start the season, and obviously we didn't start where we wanted to. But one of the strong qualities that our team has is the belief that we have in each other. And really, you know, in our sport, communication of what you think is right from a crew chief standpoint, engineer standpoint, it takes all those pieces to move something in a different direction. Aside from the mindset that you've been in for the last several years. So our team is, we've struggled before, but, you know, I think that, you know, limiting those dips and trying to make sure that you minimize the amount of time that you spend in the downside of the dip and in performance and get it back to where you need to be is one of the strengths of our team.
We're talking to Kevin Harvick. He's running for a championship this weekend. You mentioned your crew chief. So how much of this season, Kevin, is about the chemistry and the relationship you have with your crew chief, Rodney Childers?
A lot of it. You know, I think, you know, for us, we have a very unique relationship. We have a very similar background, very similar in age, both have kids. So there's a number of things that we get along and talk about outside of the racetrack, outside of racing. And, you know, the reason that I bring that up is I think it's important to spend time with each other outside of the racetrack, because in those casual conversations, there's always going to be something that comes up about the race car or something that if you're sitting there watching the Xfinity race, there's always going to be more conversation that comes in those casual conversations. And so Rodney and I, you know, this is our sixth year that we've been together, and we have a bond and belief in each other that we can show up on any weekend, even when our cars aren't running good, and figure out how to put ourselves in position to be competitive, if not, you know, win the race. So that crew chief driver relationship is what makes the good teams better than the other teams, you know, especially when you look within an organization and you have that chemistry. Chemistry and people are what it's all about.
Kevin Harvick joining me for a few more moments. You know, amazingly, despite all this, you've got some other things going on. You also have KHI Management. It's a sports marketing agency that reps a number of clients who have been on this show, in fact, including PGA golfer James Hahn, UFC star Cowboy Cerrone. In fact, I saw you tweeting about a Cowboy Conor McGregor fight. How eager are you to see that fight take place, and how do you see that going?
Well, you know, I see it going pretty good right now. Obviously, you know, I think Conor and Donald want to fight each other, and I think as you look at it, I think right now, I think everybody's just waiting on all the pieces to be put together. I know for us as an agency and Donald, we obviously want to see that happen, and you know, for me personally, I'd love to be a part of the event and go and see the whole show. So. You know, I think everything is moving along and still progressing, and we'd love to see Cowboy fight Conor.
Hey, Kevin, as a fan and as a businessman, what do you like about the UFC?
You know, I when we first got into the agency business, obviously Donald and I had a you know, a conversation, and it led to representing him, and we've had a great relationship. And I heard so many horror stories about having to deal with the UFC and Dana White. And so I went with Josh, who handles everything for Donald and I on a daily basis. And I said, well, I'm going to go to this meeting because I hear that they can be tough. It was the most professional, one of the most professional meetings that I've ever sat in my whole life. Dana White is a straight up, straightforward, good guy. He'll tell you exactly where they are, and you can be honest with him. And he has treated us like gold since the very beginning. So I love the competition in the UFC. I love the fact that, you know, one punch can make the underdog the hero. And there's just something that's, you know, intriguing about it to me from that side of things, from a competitive side of things, that just, you know, you just never know what's going to happen and enjoy watching.
Yeah, so I'm curious, like, what's it like for you when you watch one of your friends or one of your clients fight? I mean, are you comfortable or are you nervous the entire time? What's it like to sit through a fight?
Oh, it's the most uncomfortable thing that you could ever imagine. A guy that you know personally is getting in there, and the other guy wants to tear his head off. So, you know, I sit and you know, watch the fights with sweaty palms and nervous and heartbeats very, very high. You know, whatever happens. So it definitely makes me way more nervous than driving a race car. I can promise you that.
Kevin Harvick, my guest. All right, so closing it out on Sunday would mean your second title in 5 years. Have you allowed yourself to think about what it would feel like and what that would mean?
You know, it's something that, you know, when I went to Stewart Haas Racing, the first thing that Tony Stewart and I talked about was we want to be competitive on a week-to-week basis, and we want to have a chance to at least race for championships, and that's what we've done over the last 6 years. And you know, when you look back at the chance of changing teams and changing scenery and all the things that you know, were hard decisions, you wind up looking back on that and saying, man, that was one of the best decisions that I've ever made in my career. So, you know, I think sometimes I try not to think about that stuff because we try not to talk about it, but obviously it's something that you have to talk about because it's a real possibility. But our guys are really good at staying focused on the week to week battle and week to week grind, but it's been very successful, and we've won 26 or 7 races, over the 6 years, and all-star race. And so it's been something that has been a lot of fun because I get along with all the people on the race team. Tony and Gene let me be a part of the week-to-week decisions, and you get to have a lot of input into the company as well. So it's been a lot of fun for me, and there's nothing like being competitive because in the end, that's what we do. You want to be competitive, and you want to win races.
He is the driver of the number 4 Busch Light Ford Mustang for Stewart Haas Racing and one of 4 drivers with a chance to win the championship on Sunday. It is the Ford EcoBoost 400 at Homestead Miami Speedway, Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern on NBC. Kevin, great to have you back. Appreciate all the time in that visit. Good luck this weekend.
All right, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Jim Rome here. When you want expert advice, what do? You go to a pro. like some folks consider me a pro at sports. And as a pro at sports, here is some simple advice that can help you out. When you're hitting the sports book and a buddy of yours tells you he's got a sure thing, you want my pro tip? Run the other way. There is no such thing as a sure thing or a guarantee in sports. How do you think those casinos pop up out of the ground like every other week in Vegas? Also, look on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. Whether it comes to replacing your battery, getting the best bang for your buck every step of the way, better parts, better prices every day. LSU head football coach Ed Orgeron, at this point, is pretty much an American treasure, a national treasure. He really is. If you didn't know it before, you found that out Saturday when he rolled his Tigers into Bryant-Denny. Rolled up the Alabama Crimson Tide in an area rug and threw them over a bridge. 46-41. Trust me when I tell you it was not nearly as close as the scoreboard would have you believe. Speaking of rolling, as we all know by now, an LSU player rolled a live stream of Coach O's post-game locker room speech, a speech which included the now unofficial motto of Baton Rouge. Roll Tide, what? Bleep you.
Roll Tide, what? You.
Yeah!
So I did say yesterday, and let me say it again right now, if anybody associated with LSU, if anybody remotely associated with Louisiana State University wants to step up and apologize for that, I'm going to be pissed. Because that's an all-time line, and I don't want to live in a world where anybody has to pretend to be sorry for that or have to walk it back. Not only should Coach O not be sorry for that, he ought to get a pay raise and a statue for dropping that line. Yesterday, when he met with the media for the first time since going, Roll Tide, what? Bleep you? He addressed it in a couple of different ways. Number one, he talked about how he felt being recorded, or how he felt about being recorded and live streamed without his knowledge.
You know, that shouldn't happen. And I addressed a player that did it. He felt bad about it. You know, those they so used to having those phones on them all the time. You know, I think that's just the product of today. Everybody carries their phone with them all the time. I don't think it was done with malintent or nothing like that. So I addressed it with the young man. I don't think it's gonna happen again.
So in case you had any issue or any trouble understanding that glorious Cajun twang, Coach O said in part, wish that wouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. I addressed the player that did it. He felt bad about it. They're so used to having those phones on them all the time. I think it's just the product of today. Everybody carries their phone on them all the time. I don't think it was done with malintent or nothing like that. I addressed it with the young man, and I don't think it's going to happen again. End quote. 58-year-old head coach of a major college football program, being empathetic with his college-age player by describing the phone culture of 2019 while also protecting that player by not giving up his name. And he even defended the player by saying he didn't mean anything by it. It's just the culture. It's the time. It's what the kids do with their phones. I mean, wouldn't you want to play for that guy? He could have made an example out of the player. He could have been furious and could have talked about breaking locker room code, invading privacy, a breach in culture. But he's like, look, I understand how it happened. He didn't mean anything by it. It won't happen again. We're fine. As for the Roll Tide, bleep you blast, here's what Coach Ho had to say.
If I wanted that to get out, and I said that outside. It was just a fiery moment, a very emotional moment with our team. That's all that was.
Quote, if I wanted that to get out, I would have said it outside. It was just a fiery moment, a very emotional moment with our team. That's all that was, end quote. You know, I'm looking for it, but I don't see the apology in that. And I'm glad, because I don't think he had anything to apologize for. An all-time legendary line after an all-time legendary beatdown. You think Coach O is the only dude in the country dropping four-letter bombs and naming names of programs that he just beat after a huge win? It's football. their players and coaches. They're running on rocket fuel. It's one of the biggest wins ever. They're hyped out of their minds. If you drop 46 on Bama in their house, you can pretty much say whatever the hell you want inside your own room. The players should not have streamed his coach, and we shouldn't have heard what Ed O said, but we did, because he did. And then he handled it like I thought he would. The same way he handled his post-game celebration back home later that night. He handled that perfectly.
It went great. You know, I went home with Saturday night. Me and Kelly had a ham sandwich and some chips and watched SportsCenter. I mean, it was a great night.
Went home Saturday night. Me and Kelly had a ham sando, some chips, watched SportsCenter. Great night. Coach, probably the greatest night ever. Crushing ham sandos and chips with your better half while watching nationally syndicated highlights of your team crush Nick Saban and the Tide on repeat. Roll Tide? What? Bleep you!
Roll Tide? What? F*** you!
Yeah!
Ham sando and chips? What? Bleep ya!
Yeah!
What an amazing win. What an awesome moment. Roll Tide, what? Bleep you.
Yeah!
USC, what? Bleep you.
Yeah!
Yeah, you didn't need that guy. You didn't want that guy. That guy would not have helped your program. He just went into Tuscaloosa and did Bama. We are joined by PJ Fleck. PJ, there is only one way for me to start this interview, and that's by asking, how are you doing today, PJ?
I'm doing elite, Jim. Thanks for having us on the show again.
It is so good to have you back. Listen, the fact is I never have a guest on the show in back-to-back weeks. PJ, we never do this, but when you and your team do what you did on Saturday, I'm going to break that rule. What was the mood like among the players in the locker room before that game, and how confident were you that they were about to do something special?
Well, it's complete focus. You know, that's what we've been all year. You know, 0-0 type mentality, one-game championship seasons every single week. The amount of focus and discipline to do that is incredible for what our players were able to do. We talked all week about being the reason. We needed our players to be the reason, whether it was we're the reason we win or the reason we lose. You've got to stand up and be that type of leader. And I thought our leaders played tremendous. Our playmakers made plays, and they found a way to be the reason why we won that football game. And that's why I think after the game it was so emotional and so much fun for our fans and obviously our players.
We're talking to PJ Fleck. You know, to that point, the thing is, that was not a fluke win. You never trailed in that game. You led 24-10 at one point. You led 31-9 at another. So how proud were you of the way that everybody was focused, as you point out, and that they handled their business the way they did against a very good Penn State team?
Well, it's going to take everybody. We talked about that, too. It's going to take everybody. I know that's a cliche word, a saying, but it was truly going to take that. I mean, we're playing one of the best return men in the game in KJ Hamler, and I thought our kickoff team did a great job of controlling him all game. And then when you just look at the way our players played, whether it was the run game or whether it was our pass game, we were able to keep it balanced, and we needed to be able to hit explosive plays. And I thought Kirk Ciarrocca, our offensive coordinator, Joe Rossi, our defensive coordinator, Rob Wing, our special teams coordinator, put our players in the best position to be successful and gave them things that they were really good at. And they executed at the end of the day.
We're talking to PJ Fleck. You know, from talking to you over the years, it's very clear that games like Saturday were your vision. Even when people were telling you, do not take that job, you said, you know what, it sounds like a good job for me. So you've got that vision, and now that vision is reality. How does it feel? Does it feel the way you thought that it would?
Well, absolutely, because this is your vision all along. And sometimes, you know, when you have a vision like this, and we have a long way to go, don't get me wrong. We have a long way to go, but when your vision starts to come to fruition, you know, sometimes it's the less exciting for the person that has the vision or set the vision for everybody because you aren't shocked by it. You know, successful people, successful teams aren't shocked by their success because they're prepared for it and the pressure that comes with it. You have to prepare for all that. We've been preparing for that since January, and our players have known what the expectations have been. We're not afraid to talk to our players about those types of things. We're not afraid to talk about the outside world to our players inside our walls about what they're going to hear, but then let our culture dissect it and then spit it back out the way we need it to be.
PJ Fleck is joining us. You know, you and I talked about Tanner Morgan last week, and then after the game, he said something that reminded me so much of you. He said, quote, as an athlete and just in life, you should want pressure because that means your life is significant, end quote. So how much did you love hearing your quarterback and one of your leaders say something like that?
Well, bad teams, nobody leads. Average teams, coaches lead. And elite teams, players lead. And how do you know you have an elite team, player-led team, when the message of the program or the message of the culture isn't just coming from the head coach anymore? It's coming from the players, right? And that's when you know. And with, it's not just the message, it's the messengers. And Tanner Morgan's been one of the best messengers for the state of Minnesota, for the University of Minnesota, for our program and our culture. And he's not the only one. And this is the first year I think we've truly had that. And that's why you can see that we're having the success that we're having, because the best players are the hardest workers, and they're the messengers of the football team. And we're becoming a player-led team.
Minnesota head football coach P.J. Fleck joining us once again. Speaking of the state itself, you're not from Minnesota, but you have completely embraced the state. And part of the reason why you took that job was to bring back one of the most historic programs in the country. As a Chicago Cubs fan, how much do you see a parallel with the vision you have for this program? Do you see a comparison?
Well, I think it's just the same in terms of the way people had talked about it before. Like you said, about before I took the job, you know, everybody was telling me not to take the job. You can get a better job. My mind immediately shifts it towards, well, I want to make it the best job then. That sounds perfect. And I think that's where, you know, being a Chicago Cubs fan, being able to watch that whole run that they had, and a lot of my staff being from Chicago, we were so involved in that, because everybody said that was impossible. And everybody said, well, we have a curse. And there was so much consistency and so much pressure that those players and the manager and the team and the organization had to be able to overcome, but they embraced it. They embraced that type of pressure, because it only comes around very often, and you've got to be able to handle it. You got to be prepared for it. You got to be able to excel in it. So we have talked to our players about that. We did an off-season team meeting about the Chicago Cubs and every other team who hadn't done something for a very long time. But we still have a long way to go for that to be able to even happen. And we got to take one game at a time and continue to create this one-game championship mentality in our players' minds every single week.
And another big game coming up, which I will get to momentarily. P.J. Fleck is joining us on the show. You mentioned other jobs. Because of the success you've had, your name was coming up in connection with other jobs. But last week, you signed an extension that's going to keep you at Minnesota. What did you want people to know about that extension and what that says about your commitment to Minnesota and what you're building there?
Well, I think it just shows the importance of the state of Minnesota having cultural sustainability over a long period of time. When you look at teams like Iowa, Wisconsin, even Northwestern, the success they've had with Pat Fitzgerald, it's being able to take the highs with the high and the low with the lows, and being able to have that sustainability over a long period of time. We play in one of the most competitive conferences in all of college football. There's going to be really good seasons. There's going to be tough seasons. But to be able to have that cultural sustainability gives you a chance every year to win championships. I'm a Midwest guy. I've absolutely loved my time here. Minnesota has embraced Heather and my family, my kids, with open arms. And I absolutely love coaching the team that I get to coach and be able to run the program and the culture how we get to do that. Mark Coyle, our athletic director, deserves all the credit for that, because you know, he's allowing us to be able to restore that tradition our way, which we truly appreciate.
So to your point, PJ, you know how this goes. Your next game is your biggest game and your biggest game of the season, and that's Saturday at Iowa. How do you go about preparing your guys to face that challenge, especially coming off the week they just had?
Well, the biggest thing is bring them right back to reality, and that's what the culture does. I mean, Sunday they came out. We had a tremendous practice on Sunday night under the lights. We had a little bit of snow going on, so it was perfect. But they came back and responded perfectly of what we wanted them to be able to do. They understand everything. They understand there's a big rivalry. They understand what's on the line. But we want them to understand that, because that's what they're prepared for. We haven't won at Kinnick Stadium for 20 years as a program. And this is one of those things that you want to be one of the first, or you want to do things that haven't happened in a long time. And like you said, we're 9-0 for the first time since 1904, since, you know, the Wright brothers flew in a circle in their first airplane, and the wet razor blades were invented, and fingerprint identification was invented, and those types of things. So we bring them right back to reality, celebrate with them, but then we move on very quickly. And this team is very mature. They can handle that. And we hope that they continue to go through the week with that same type mentality.
So specifically, when you look at Iowa, what concerns you the most about them?
Everything again, right? I mean, their defense is one of the top 10 defenses in the country. Iowa plays Iowa football, and that's what we mean about that cultural sustainability, whether it's Hayden Fry or whether it's been Coach Ferentz. They tackle really well. They take care of the football, right? They don't beat themselves, and they play really good football. And it's at Kinnick Stadium that creates a tremendous college football environment. And they don't beat themselves. And we've got to find a way to play our best football. We can't worry about what they're going to do. We've got to worry about what we can do better than we did last week and just be a better football team.
And then finally, when you take time to show your players a video that puts their accomplishments in historical perspective, you kind of laid that out a moment ago, but now you're 9-0 for the first time in 115 years. How do you go about approaching that particular video?
Constantly, because they don't even know what you're talking about.
Right.
You start talking about Teddy Roosevelt breaking up the big trusts and things like that. You know, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies. You start talking about the ice cream cone was invented in 1904. They're looking at you like you have seven heads, because they also look at you and say, is it true? Because
right.
Usually, you know, when you had your parents tell you something, you believed it. When my parents told me something, I believed it. They immediately go right to their phone and ask Siri, or they ask Alexa, or they Google it. You better be right with your facts, first and foremost, or they'll call you out. So we did a lot of homework before we presented it to them.
Minnesota Golden Gophers head football coach P.J. Fleck, my guest. Again, we never do this back-to-back, but when you have the kind of week they had, it does warrant going back-to-back. They are 9-0. They're number 7 in both polls. They're coming off that win over Penn State. Next challenge, number 18, Iowa Saturday. P.J., great to have you. I know that was a great win. You're on to the next thing. Good luck this weekend. Hey, I don't know, man. Maybe back-to-back-to-back if you handle your business. But then we'll get them when we get there. So good luck this weekend.
I appreciate it, Jim. Row the boat, Skelly Mago, Gophers. Thanks a lot.
Now, if you remember the aftermath of the so-called BMF fight, you know, baddest mother bleeper, between Nate Diaz and Jorge Masvidal, folks were running pretty hot. Emotions were running pretty high after that fight. Remember, Nate was bent because he thought the fight would stop prematurely because of that cut. He was insisting immediately on a rematch, but he was concerned that the UFC would not allow it. Then you have Jorge, the winner and the official BMF title holder, but he was upset. He won the fight, and he was upset. He was upset because he did not get to finish the fight.
For a fact, I told Nate right now, I swear on it, we're running it back, man. You gave me the love, I'm going to give it right back. UFC lets it happen, just run it back. I don't like to leave the ring like this with my opponent conscious. There's only one way to do it, and that's to baptize him. I didn't get to baptize Nate, you know, so we're going to run it back.
And this is why Masvidal is the reigning BMF champ. Because despite winning that fight, and pretty impressively, I might add, he's still pissed because his opponent was able to leave and he was not unconscious. And because he was not unconscious and they stopped the fight because of a cut, Masvidal was unable to baptize him properly. So the guy who lost is pissed. The guy who won is pissed. And the folks who thought that they were going to see a baptism were pissed. What an incredible night. And of course, it did not end there, because now we have a new fighter who has entered the cage, and he also is not happy. Nick Diaz. Nicholas is not happy with Jorge. Now, Nick, of course, is Nate's older bro. The two of them are extremely close. Nick has not fought since 2015. Nick also has not done a sit-down interview in quite some time. So if Nick Diaz is getting in front of a camera, it's because he's got something to say. And my man really did have something he wanted to say. So he sits down with Ariel Helwani, gives his thoughts on a number of topics, starting with whether or not he is going to fight again.
I mean, generally I go in and I show somebody their life. It's up to them whether they want to deal with their, you know what I mean? Like, and that's just what I do. That's my job. It's been that way because I was doing that to people when I was 15 years old to get them to come with me when I was going to deal with, like, because I've been doing karate when I was a little baby, a little kid, like, you know, karate chop. Whoops. You know what I mean? Like, what, you know, I was a real karate kid.
All right, so this is what I do. They have to decide whether or not they want to deal with that, but I'm like the real karate kid. Now, if that sounds like a BMF, it's because Nick is a BMF. In fact, Nick says that he believes the BMF belt belongs to him.
The BMF, the 107, that's my belt. But I'm not going to get in my brother's way of taking it. You know what I mean? I'm like, as far as I'm concerned, that's my belt. I'm like, you just fought my baby brother. You know what I mean? And the reason why I say that, I'm like, he ain't got nothing to be mad about. Like, he ain't tripping.
All right, so what he's saying is, look, that's my belt. They didn't fight for the belt. I'm wearing the belt. You fought my baby brother, but it's my belt. Like, if they had been handing that belt out in the past, I'd be wearing it for years. It's already my belt. They're not fighting for my belt, but I'm not going to get in the way of my baby bro. And then he got to the good stuff, the really good stuff. His reaction to Jorge saying that he wanted to baptize baby bro. And these thoughts are pretty amazing.
You want to talk about baptizing my younger brother? That's on you. I never had nothing disrespectful to say, but like you don't talk about baptizing my younger brother. So you're already in a position if you fight with me. You don't talk about baptizing someone's younger brother. That's my baby brother. You don't talk like that to nobody.
All right, so again, I know there's a lot of you that have no need for this. A lot of you who do not care about MMA. But how can you hear something like that and not be interested? It's one of the greatest quotes ever. That's the very definition of fighting words. Quote, you want to talk about baptizing my younger brother? That's on you. Like, you don't talk about baptizing my younger brother, so you're already in a bleeped position if you fight with me. You don't bleeping talk about baptizing somebody's younger brother. That's my baby brother. You don't talk like that to nobody. End quote. That's what he said. Alvin, run that one more time.
You want to talk about baptizing my younger brother? That's on you. I never had nothing disrespectful to say, but like you don't talk about baptizing my younger brother. So you're already in a position if you fight with me. You don't talk about baptizing someone's younger brother. That's my baby brother. You don't talk like that to nobody.
So the list of reasons to go is already pretty small, but go ahead and add baptizing my younger brother to that list. You know, I might be wrong, but knowing the Diaz brothers, that does not sound like blowing smoke just to get another fight. That's not Nick coming forward and talking junk so Nate can get a rematch or so Nick can get a fight. Remember, Nate had gone like 3 years without a fight. Nick hasn't fought since 2015. They're not doing that to get fights. That's not blowing smoke. That's offering the smoke. That's coming with the smoke. Nick is pissed. Genuinely pissed. That's not about money. That's not about a belt. You're being disrespectful to his baby brother. You're talking about baptizing his baby brother. You don't talk about Nick Diaz's baby brother like that. You do that and you're, quote, already in a bleeped position with him. There's a list of guys you do not want to get on the wrong side of. A list of guys you do not want to get into a, quote, bleeped position with. And Nick and Nate Diaz are right at the top of the list. Now, if this had ended right there, it already would have been amazing. But, of course, it doesn't end right there. Like, if Masvidal had been in that room, Nick would have gone after him, and he would have done it for free. Actually, he would have done something. Like, you can't put a dollar amount on this, on Diaz pride, Diaz honor, Diaz dignity, Diaz respect. And Masvidal disrespected the Diaz family with that comment that he was pissed because he was looking to baptize Nate and was not able to do so. So, as I started to say, if that thing had ended right there, it would be amazing. But it didn't end right there because it did work its way back to Masvidal. And a few hours later, we found out that he had a response because his coach took to Instagram to post a video with a caption. Game Bred Fighters official response to Nick Diaz. Hashtag super necessary. Hashtag baptized. Hashtag BMF. Check this out.
These Diaz brothers. I've buried those cockroaches.
The audio does not do that justice. The animation is incredible. I mean, it's Scarface. If you see this on Instagram, it is Scarface, except with an animated Jorge Masvidal. It's incredible, and it's perfect. and he's saying, bleep the Diazes.
The f***ing Diaz brothers, f*** them all. I've buried those cockroaches.
Bleep the Diaz brothers, bleep them all. I bury those cockroaches. It's Scarface, but an animated Masvidal. F-bombs and all. Because if you thought Jorge Masvidal was going to hear Nick Diaz comment and not say something back, you were wrong. There is a reason why he has the BMF belt. Did you think this guy was going to say nothing? Did you think this guy was going to apologize? Hell no. That belt is about more than just winning a fight. It's about a mentality. It's a lifestyle. And the BMF holder is not going to be scared off by the older brother doing an interview. Nothing like Jorge Masvidal, nothing like the Diaz bros, nothing like the UFC. If you just put the belt on the table, these guys would go. It's not about money, it's about respect and what you can and cannot say about that family. It's incredible. No other sport can come close to that. They shouldn't even bother to try. Remember when NBA Twitter was such a thing, like the biggest thing? And it was pretty awesome. Nothing compared to UFC social. I don't know what I want more. A Nick Diaz, Jorge Masvidal fight, a Nate Diaz, Jorge Masvidal fight, some sort of tag team event where the Diaz bros are in the cage. Because if we don't get that, I'm afraid both these crews are going to meet up in the street and settle it right there. So you better set it up and do it the right way and get everybody paid rather than risk somebody losing their life, folks going to jail, nobody seeing it, and nobody gets paid. I know this. I need more, lots more. And anybody who thought that this sport and the UFC would not thrive without Conor McGregor or Ronda Rousey obviously did not know what they were talking about. Because the most riveting thing in the sport, in any sport right now, does not even involve a championship belt. It involves something even more important than that, the BMF belt. And you're going to have to do some serious damage if you're going to rip it from Jorge.
Good night.